Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona, and I was married for 30 years and in that relationship for 32. And we didn't find out we were a neurodiverse couple until our 29th year of marriage. And I've been divorced almost 5 years, and together we have an amazing adult daughter who's thriving and doing fantastic. And today I am joined again by my wonderful guest co-host, Nicole Knowlton, and this will be our last episode together. So Nicole, welcome back to the show, and I'd love it if you could introduce yourself to the listeners.
Hi, Mona. Thank you so much. It's great to be back. I am a neurodivergent therapist. I am autistic with ADHD. I was also married in a neurodiverse relationship, and I have two neurodiverse teenagers.
Thank you so much. And today we're going to talk about some topics that are probably going to be pretty heavy for the listeners. But we came up with these topics because they're really important and they really do impact a lot of folks in very different ways. And I think sometimes it's difficult to have these conversations either with your partner or with friends, and maybe even to start the conversation with a therapist or coach. So hopefully this will be helpful to a lot of folks, and you can even, you know, have played the episode to your partner or to a family member or friend. And so we're going to talk about the emotional and mental and behavioral impact of being neurodivergent and maybe not knowing you're neurodivergent, and also other mental health challenges that you may experience if you're neurodivergent and if you're not neurodivergent. And so I think this is really important because I posted on Instagram recently about my challenge, Nicole, with depression. And I've said it before on the podcast, I have 3 degrees. I have a bachelor's and a master's and a PhD in social work, right? And when my daughter was born in the mid-90s, I literally cried every day for 2 years. I didn't realize I had postpartum depression until after I think I finished going through this just really challenging mental health time in my life. And I fought going on medication and never did, you know, because I thought I'm a social worker. I was raised by two PhD psychologists. I can do this. And I couldn't. And I think on and off, I have dealt with depression and some anxiety, but mostly depression for, you know, most of my 30s and beyond. And I can't imagine what it's like to not know you're neurodivergent or not know why you're feeling the way you're feeling and acting the way you're acting in your own life, in your relationships, whether it's family, friends, an intimate relationship, or work. And I'd love to hear your thoughts because I know you're late identified neurodivergent. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on maybe what you've seen or what your personal journey has been. Either one.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate that. And I'm so sorry hearing, you know, about what you went through, especially during such a beautiful time when, you know, you have a new baby and to struggle like that, you know, I can imagine that must have been really, really hard. I'm glad that you eventually, you know, found medication, but makes me sad when I hear that for you.
Thank you, Nicole.
So I think the great takeaway on that is that if, you know, you need it, if you could benefit from medication, why not? Why not, you know, do whatever you can in order to help yourself? And so I think so many of us kind of resist that for whatever ideas we have surrounding it, whether that be the neurodivergent or the neurotypical person. I think that, you know, if you are going through a difficult time and coming out of this pandemic, just like with trauma, really the time when we start healing after, you know, a significant event is after the event is over. Mm-hmm. And so I'm anticipating, you know, a lot of people that will be struggling. I think they have been, but we're really going to see more. So if you're noticing, for those listeners out there, if you're noticing symptoms of, you know, depression or anxiety, or you're really having a difficult time, try to, you know, look into if there are other ways that maybe could help. But I'd like to, you know, just kind of talk a little bit, and I appreciate, you know, you giving space and time for this perspective, because I know that, you know, the focus is on the neurodiverse relationship, and this is an important piece of it. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very difficult for us to be able to walk in each other's shoes when you're neurodivergent versus when you're neurotypical. Mm-hmm. It's really difficult. And, you know, I'd like to just kind of share a little bit of, you know, why that is, and what it's like. And, you know, what I try to do with my couples is there's an exercise that I like to assign for homework and, you know, to process. And that's an assignment of walking in each other's shoes. What is it like to wake up for your partner when they wake up? Every, you know, action, thought, feeling, what is it like for them? What is it like for you? And then, you know, we exchange that. And it's, you know, it's so interesting to hear, you know, what comes out. Like, for an example, there was a couple who was talking about how frustrating it can be because one partner, you know, will take a long period of time to choose a parking spot. Mm-hmm. And that other partner will just go into the first one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the amount of mental energy that's expended for the neurodivergent person is, you know, there's a lot of rules they want to follow. And so that's using up brain power, right? And the neurodivergent or the neurotypical person, it's like, you know, very minute amount of energy to just park. But mm-hmm. that's like 5 times more work to do a simple task. That's what it's like to be neurodivergent. And it's not because we're rigid, or it's not because we're wanting to, you know, be perfectionists or anything along those lines. It's just, that's how our mind works. We're overthinkers. So we're just, you know, predisposed to experiencing the world very cautiously. And we think things through, and there's really no changing that. Right. Mm-hmm. And so if you can just imagine that for me to function every day, it takes me about 5 times more mental energy than it takes you. Or, well, I mean, you have ADHD, so you've got your own, you know, your own challenges. But for a typical, you know, for a neurotypical, it takes me 5 times more energy, more mental energy to function. So I get depleted sooner, and I've got a limit on how much energy I can expend. And when I'm done and I've reached my limit, I'm done. I don't have more to give. And it's not that I don't want to. It's not that I don't love the people around me, or I don't love my partner. It's that I'm expending so much energy just to function. And when being undiagnosed, for those individuals, you know, granted, I'm a female and I have ADHD. So my presentation of autism looks significantly different than an individual without ADHD. Mm-hmm. And I would describe that as being like having OCD and having like a party. I can be a fun party, but I also have that rigidity, right? So I can be scrambled and I'm fun and impulsive, but I'm also at my core very rigid. And most people understand OCD. So I like to use that as like a, you know, description, because there is still a big significant core part of me that is incredibly rigid. And I have things that must be done in order for me to function, or, you know, I can't. And So if you can envision some people, that have that combination, they just, they look differently. And so you wouldn't even guess that, I have autism. But with that makes it a little easier for me probably because of that. I'm a little bit I bypass that rigidity with the ADHD, and I'm able to do a lot more, I think, maybe socially, or it's probably why I'm able to be a clinician and do some things I've done. However, what life has looked like, and this is, the seriousness of what being neurodivergent looks like, and that's that our society is set up to, educate and feed and be able to provide safety to the masses. So you can't, it's very hard to provide accommodations for, that minority group that don't, receive information or cannot function like the masses. And so it's hard to be able to get your needs met. And we've talked about that in, in prior podcasts. And the internal message that is received, and especially if you're in an intolerant family, and maybe even, I mean, there's often probably neurodiversity there, but if you're in a military family, if you're in, a conservative family, if you're just depending on whatever the family looks like, being different and having, special needs is really not really tolerated or well received. You're taught to really toughen up. You can be taught to toughen up, right? I mean, there's a lot of families out there that aren't, that don't have this perspective. And what I would love to recommend is there's an amazing book that one of my clients actually directed me to, which I'm so grateful for. There's a book called Sincerely, Your Autistic Child. And so if you have a daughter who's autistic, I would encourage you, if you are a female who's autistic and listening to this podcast, I would encourage you read it. It's wonderful. It's really, really wonderful. It's written by a number of different females on the spectrum. But it helps paint a picture of what it's like. And that leads us to, the heavy part. And I'm gonna just give a warning to everyone. We're gonna talk about, some self-harm and suicidal ideation. So this could be a little triggering. So if you're listening, please take care of yourself and understand that this is not an abnormal feeling or thought to have. And I think it's really important to talk about, and especially in therapy, there's this fear of having a therapist break confidentiality and call and have you committed or hospitalized if you say the word suicide. I'm feeling suicidal. And the reality is that the statistics for individuals that are neurodivergent, particularly with autism, is staggering. There are so many completed, or I don't even want to say that because I'm going to say it's you're dying by suicide. I mean, this is not you're not in a mindset of being able to make a choice. You're so broken, and you're suffering, and you believe in your heart that your family, your children, they will be better off without you. Because you're judging yourself so hard, and it's just so difficult to function. And especially if you don't have the support, if you don't have the understanding, if you just have people around you constantly correcting you or trying to change who you are at your core, it's devastating. And so many couples out there, if there's neurodiversity, your child may be neurodivergent. And if that's the case, I urge anyone to just think about that for a second and consider that. And if that's the case, then do some, reading. And I don't even need to say that to your listeners. I mean, your listeners are incredible researchers and knowledgeable. And but we live, I think, a little bit in denial and fear. We can be just struggling with our relationship and not even see those signs showing up in our children.
Right.
And I think that what helped me along my way in identifying my neurodivergence was through my children, through their assessments. And then that started the ball rolling where I realized, holy cow, that's me too. And so just going back to though, the severity of that hopelessness and depression. Depression and anxiety are things that I think you really just are diagnosed with when you're neurodivergent. And because you really are experiencing depression and anxiety, but it's not by itself. It's tied to the fact that I'm alone in this world. Nobody understands me. The people that I love and care about are trying to change me and they're correcting me and they're not happy with who I am. Nothing I'm doing or my natural behaviors are hurting others. And I don't know why, and I don't know how to fix it. And so if you can imagine what that's like, and I'm upsetting people, I'm ending relationships with people, not intentionally. People are just will just stop talking to me. I might be getting fired from jobs, and I don't know why. I don't know what I did. I was just being me. And that's so scary. Because, as human beings, we don't want to be alone. People that are neurodivergent, we don't want to be alone. We're safer alone. And that's what sort of motivates us to isolate and just find a place that we can feel safe and we can feel accepted. And then we're comfortable and able to thrive. And so there's a lot of misconceptions, and the reality is we don't have a lot of science. We don't know. We're figuring things out right now as we go. And I think, from my own experience, I've struggled. I have struggled many times. And so for my clients that I work with, I will bring up suicide and self-harm and talk about it because it's real and it's better to talk about it than have it take place. I've lost people in the past, and you wish that, gosh, why didn't that person reach out to me? Why didn't, that then we're angry at them, we blame them, they're selfish. And I'll tell you, when I was struggling, those were the messages that I received. You are so selfish. And yeah, there is, I can see why someone who's never been in that position would feel that way.
Nicole, I mean, just so many thoughts are going through my head, but first, I just want to thank you for being so vulnerable and raw and sharing all of that. I think there's just you sharing so openly and honestly is going, I mean, I'm tearing up because for a few reasons, I can't imagine your pain. I really can't. And I just like want to hug you through, through the electronics and just say, I have a magic wand, let's make all this go away. But it can't go away. And it's trauma. Any way you look at it is trauma. And probably most of what you experienced was big T trauma. And you were just trying to be yourself and be the best version of you. And you were criticized, you were invalidated, you were made to be in such a challenging or evil person. And I know that I did this in my marriage, and I'm very upfront about this in the podcast because I've said I've apologized I don't know how many times to my ex. And he always says it's okay, we're all different, we all make mistakes. And as far as I'm concerned, No, it isn't okay, because anytime any of us cause harm to somebody we love, I think there's got to be kind of almost a process that we go through of forgiveness, but then of healing and acceptance. And whether we go through it individually or we go through it with the people that have caused the harm, whether they meant to or not, it all depends on the other person. But I know we're all here to learn, but sometimes in the process of learning, we realize that there's been a lot of unintentional pain that either we've caused or we've experienced. And I feel like this episode is allowing folks to feel validated, and also we're normalizing some of this because, I have several friends that committed suicide and or died by suicide. I know the terminology has changed, and I look back and they were absolutely neurodivergent, absolutely neurodivergent, and nobody knew back then. This was, the late 80s, early 90s. So I know, Nicole, you've shared, and I've shared a little bit. I know there are so many other things that I've heard neurodivergent, especially autistic folks, share about other, I hate this word, but I'm going to use it because people understand it, the comorbidities, the co-occurring physical and mental challenges that may occur when there's unidentified neurodiversity and identified neurodiversity. So, do you want to share at all a little bit about some of the co-occurring things that can occur or that you've seen, and any words of advice or thoughts about how folks may even recognize it and then maybe deal with some of those things if they see that they're happening in their bodies or their lives?
Yes, that's I could go a lot of different directions
Yeah,
there.
you go
What
whatever
came
direction feels best. Yeah.
Okay. Well, gosh. First of all, from an assessment perspective, if you are neurodivergent, you may not just be autistic. There's a high percentage of ADHD with autism, and there's other, there's other learning challenges, sensory challenges, or differences that can also be present that I think are important to include, such as, is there dyslexia, dyspraxia? Are there delays in processing, thinking? You may have visual processing or cognitive, processing, which is slower, but it doesn't mean that, it obviously many, many, many people on the spectrum, they are not on the lower end cognitively of the spectrum. And so, but it just may take a little longer to process what you're reading or what you're seeing or what you're hearing and thinking, and particularly if you are engaging in a social setting or in an emotionally charged situation, it takes a while because you have to bypass your emotional state. And I'll give a quick example where this was really difficult. When I was in law school, I, like you, I have a lot of education. I have a dual master's and a law degree. And law school was so scary for me because in several classes, in order to teach you to think on your feet, you get called on. And then, they do what's called the Socratic method, and then they challenge you, and you really have to know your case and your argument and work through that discomfort. And being neurodivergent, I never really numbed to that discomfort, and I would just shut down. And so I, it was a challenge. Why am I not building this, this strength, and other people are? Well, it's because my nervous system just wouldn't, it wasn't improving. So I would say that's, that discomfort, if you're not able to see any improvement there, it's, you know, it's probably, you know, if that anxiety is just not tameable, it's probably, you know, due to some neurology there. But there's often PTSD symptoms that can emerge because, you know, our body's extremely sensitive. And I was just giving this image yesterday to a friend about how it's sort of like if anyone's ever seen that National Lampoon's Christmas, mm-hmm. How there's like a visual that they assign to it where, you know, Mr. Griswold is, you know, trying to hang the lights and his whole body is electrified like a skeleton, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if you can imagine that, but that's kind of what I see myself as at the end of a really, really hard day. Like, that's me.
Wow. That you're so fried? Is that what you're saying? Like, you're so fried.
Yes. Wow. Like if you can, and I don't know if, you know, anyone's seen that, but that's like an example. You are just so done and fried and just, you have nothing left, you know, to give, and you're to expect to get up and be able to function and contribute like everybody else. It's really just unrealistic. And I hate to say that because I know that neurotypical partners are doing so much, and it can be just devastating to imagine that even if you're doing work together, that you're going to be carrying, you know, some more of the more laborious tasks or things that, you know, the neurodivergent person just can't do. I mean, it's hard. Or your neurodivergent child. Yeah. But coming to an acceptance and realizing this is not a choice. I mean, I've said in the past that yes, I love the gifts that come along with it. However, you know, the just challenge and difficulty, it makes it pretty tough to be living in this, you know, in this time. Maybe in, you know, 50 years, 100 years from now, things will be a lot different, but it's better than it was. Absolutely. Right. But it's still really, really difficult, especially if you don't have a strong advocate helping pave your way and figure things out. And that's a reason I went into law is I learned special education. I learned how to navigate the school system for myself and for my children. And if you know how to do that, it can make things much easier. And there is no shame, just like in taking medication, there is no shame in creating an educational environment that supports your needs. That's why you're paying taxes. Mm-hmm. That is not putting a label on a child. That is setting them up for success. If you're not going to put them in a private school that is better suited for their learning style, then I want to encourage people, get accommodations for your child, get the testing, the assessments. The school is not going to look at your child unless they're failing. And that doesn't do them any good because they're struggling. I guarantee internally they're struggling. Even if their grades look good, if they're coming home and having meltdowns, that is a symptom and a sign that your child needs help at school. Right. So let that, you know, hopefully that's helpful.
Yeah.
And one more thing I want to say before we move on is a lot. I think if you're listening to this podcast, you may have had this thought. You may still be kind of pondering it. But Asperger's, or hopefully no one is offended by that term, but I use it. It doesn't have the same meaning to me as it does to some. However, I'll say. An individual with autism who has low support needs. That's the language that we use now. Mm-hmm. Because of their communication style or their confidence or their perspective taking, many partners confuse that as being a narcissistic personality disorder.
Yes.
So many neurotypicals come in and say, I think my husband's or my partner is narcissistic. Yeah. And that's probably not the case. And so I just want to sort of put that out there as well.
Yeah, I think, again, everything that you've said is so powerful, is going to be very, very emotional for a lot of folks to hear, and is real. And I think, like you said, we just don't have enough research on what it's like to be neurodivergent in a primarily neurotypical world. We don't have enough research on neurodivergent women or girls. We don't have enough research on, all these comorbidities or co-occurring issues. We definitely don't have enough research on how relationships, whether it's family relationships, work relationships, or intimate relationships, thrive when there's neurodivergence or other differences, whether it's mental health issues or what have you. And so, again, Nicole, thank you so much for sharing so openly and being so vulnerable, because I know it's going to help a lot of people. I do, and I've said this before on the podcast, I do offer a neuro diverse couple support group. I've been doing it for about a year, and I love doing it, Nicole. And I know you see couples in your therapy practice. I love doing it because it's really, for me, it's about psychoeducation. It's about educating both partners about what's unique and different about each of them and what might be the strengths. And then for the first time in their lives, they're meeting other neurodiverse couples. And so one of the things that I think is a light bulb moment for a lot of couples is when they hear the kind of vulnerable sharing that you just did. And I can tell you, there have been tears, there have been moments of just absolute complete silence, and partners, a lot of them turn their mic off when it gets emotional, and they're looking at each other with such love. And I'm sure many of them are saying, "I'm sorry." Whether it's the autistic or neurodivergent partner or the non-autistic, more neurotypical partner. And I know it had to be hard for my ex-husband to watch me cry every day for 2 years. I can't even imagine. Seriously, I can't even imagine what he went through. I was 32 to 34. I was working full time. I was getting my PhD. I was a full time mother, loved my daughter. There was, we bonded and all that stuff. It wasn't anything like that. But I literally cried every day. I tried to hide it from him a little bit and would cry in the shower. But you can't really hide that, in the swelling under my eyes and all that stuff. And I put on my best face, and I could call it masking, because I was a very optimistic and very happy person before that. So I can't even imagine what he went through. And I've thanked him, and I'm thanking him. I don't know if he listens to the podcast, but I'm thanking him publicly. He was my rock. He was absolutely my rock, because we lived in California and our family was in Florida, and I did not have the support of my parents or my sister or anybody else. I know that the neurotypical or non-autistic partners that are listening, many of them are probably tearing up. They had no idea of the depth of the pain, emotional and physical and other types of pain, spiritual pain, that their partner may have been experiencing, because maybe their partner doesn't even know the right words to share what they're going through. And I know the neurotypical partners are saying, I'm feeling things too. And I know that understanding, Nicole, is the first step in having more grace and compassion for your partner. But then you really have to accept each other. And you said it so eloquently and beautifully when you're constantly telling your partner that they're wrong, or you're asking them to change. That's creating a traumatic and oftentimes a toxic environment. So, and I say this all the time, if when you find out that you're in a neurodiverse relationship, whether you're the autistic partner or the non-autistic neurotypical partner, it's an opportunity for you to re-examine whether the relationship you're in is the right relationship, because you can still love each other and you can still care deeply about each other, but no longer be able to be understanding and accepting of who your partner's authentic self is. So I don't know if you want to comment or say anything around that, but I just feel, I felt the need to share that, because that's why I'm divorced. You know, in this month, it'll be 5 years. I still care about my husband, my ex-husband. I always will. I'm not in love with him anymore. I haven't talked to him in 2 years. I don't know if we'll talk again. I don't know. But I love that he was there for me. I hope he appreciates that I was there for him. And I wish we had known more about each other's neurodiversity, mental health challenges, because he has a lot of co-occurring issues too. So thoughts, Nicole? Anything you want to say regarding it?
I do. I have a few things to say. And thank you so much for your kind words and support and that you're doing this and providing, you know, this podcast to everyone out there that's listening. And I know that you are, you know, changing lives and helping people significantly. And I think this is, you know, so wonderful that people have access to this, because it's, you know, it changes, it promotes a shift in the relationship. I think that can help, whether that is staying together or not staying together, but helping everyone heal, theoretically, and be better parents to their children who, you know, maybe neurodivergent. There's something that I wanted to say that, and this, you know, could be a whole entire other podcast, but I just want to touch on it. And that's that there's a lot of substance abuse for neurodivergent people. Yeah. And that is because of so much pressure and needing to numb but not liking to be, you know, intellectually compromised. Alcohol is usually the choice because it numbs the system, and you can help relax, you can control it, but it can be, you know, a concern for some partners, because it appears as maybe they're developing alcoholism, or they have alcoholism or an addiction, or it's been in the family. And so I want to encourage anyone who's dealing with that, you know, hopefully you're in therapy. There's good information out there about this, that it isn't, it's something to treat delicately, because it isn't a behavior that's intended to escape life. It's just a sort of self-medicating, return to balance type behavior. So I would encourage more exploration there. There's a great book by Sarah Hendricks out there called Asperger's and Alcohol, I think.
Yeah.
The name of it. Have you heard of it?
Yeah. And there's another one, I'll put it in the show notes, that I have. It's by a gentleman who didn't realize he was autistic and almost killed himself with his alcoholism. Okay. I'll put those in the show notes. Yeah.
So with regard to, so that, I think that kind of touches on what we were just talking about with co-occurring or comorbidity. It could be, you know, there's substance abuse there. And I'll tell you, I've worked in a number of substance abuse or chemical dependency facilities, all the way from, you know, Malibu level to, you know, county funded. And we're never looking for autism. Yeah. Never. And that is something, you're not going to find it, even if your partner's been in treatment. They're not going to find it, just because they're not trained to be looking for it. So just want to throw that out there. But get talk to a therapist, talk to a professional if that's going on in your family. There's a way that it can be, you know, addressed in a healthy manner. And also for yourselves, if you know, you're worried. The other thing I want to touch on is that what I see, curiously, and what I hear from colleagues are some of the characteristics about neurodivergent partners that are attractive, initially, like strong stability. There's stability, there's security, there's strong values financially. You know, maybe they're very conservative, and but it exudes safety, which a lot of females, neurotypical females, that's what, is one of the main things, traits that we're looking for a lot of different reasons, right? And that emanates from, a neurodivergent partner. And what's difficult, at least when it comes to male-female neurodiversity, with the male being the neurodivergent, is that, we have a lot of male toxicity in our culture. And that looks like men are not taught that it's okay to be, emotional or weak or vulnerable, right? They're taught you need to exude this strength. And so here we're talking about what it's like to be neurodivergent, and it's really difficult inside. Internally, we have a lot of pain, and we have a lot of disconnect and shutdown because we can't manage all of the sensitivity that, that our bodies are experiencing. And what I want to pose is this question that has come out through, a lot of research that's done on the impact of male toxicity, which is, in essence, this message that men are judged by their economic status, their, sexual conquests, and their physical strength or emotional strength. And so the question that has come up is that the people who judge them the most can be the women that they're with, because their women are seeking that strength from their partner. And if they see that their partner is exhibiting some vulnerability or weakness, it's terrifying for the neurotypical female, and they can't tolerate that. And so it is instead shut down because they can't handle that. And so it doesn't allow reality to be, seen or accepted. We can't accept that our partners have that. And so that's something that I think is an element here that could be considered as well. Just being curious about that. Is that something? What's going on inside of you if, you are a female neurotypical and you're imagining your male neurodivergent partner having a vulnerability? Are you do you have the ability to accept that and be okay with it and not be afraid that his vulnerability puts your safety at risk? Because it doesn't. It doesn't, right? Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. And I know, I think I've recommended this book on the podcast before, but I read The Origins of You by Vanna Farren, and it came out this past year or this year. It is one of the best books that I have read in a long time. And I read a lot of books every year. And the reason it is so good is she talks about our wounds, and there's five of them, and I don't have them all memorized, but we pick partners oftentimes who we think can heal our wounds, even though we don't understand our wounds, right? And so I know why I picked my ex-husband. And I'm not going to go into it in any detail, but when he showed me his more vulnerable sides and he no longer lived up to the expectation I had of him, which happened very quickly. I wanted a divorce after 4 years of marriage. I think I did not let him be his true self. He showed me a side of him that I was not comfortable with, and part of that was not being as financially stable as I thought he should be at the point we were in our relationship. We were like 27 years old, where I had a bachelor's and a master's and was much more secure in my career. And I know I hear this from a lot of folks where, the partner who's autistic may be a leader in their field and then may spend no time at home. Or when they come home, like you talked about, they have zero spoons. They have nothing to give anymore. And so there's no emotional reciprocity. There's no, active listening or any of that, but they are thriving financially. So that thing you were attracted to, they're doing the best that they possibly can and really succeeding, but there's other pieces that are missing, which I know for a lot of neurotypicals causes a lot of emotional distress and loneliness. But the thing is, I think oftentimes, Nicole, and this probably goes for, all partners, we aren't clear about what we want and need at the beginning of our relationship. I think we oftentimes get caught up in the fantasy of what we think we have in the relationship. And it's hard to be vulnerable. It's hard to ask for what you want because you're afraid if your partner isn't going to give it to you or they don't know how to give it to you. Are you ready to think about whether you want to stay in the relationship or not? I'm not saying if your partner's not going to meet one of your needs, you're out. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying, the whole container of the relationship, if you find that there's more that you're not getting that you thought you would be getting. So this is really important and really powerful. And I want to speak a little bit to the substance abuse issue because it was a major, major issue in the relationship I had with the man I dated for almost a year after I divorced. He kept asking me if I thought he was autistic, and I didn't know because he was so different from my ex-husband, but I now know he absolutely is. And he was a high functioning alcoholic. And it became a, it wasn't a challenge for me because his personality didn't change when he drank for the worse. It actually mellowed him out, as you were saying. We'd go to social events and he'd ask me, is there going to be beer or liquor there? And I'd say, yeah. And he goes, well, don't worry about it then, I'm fine. And within like the first 5 minutes of the event, he would have already had three beers. And I know now why. And so I think this is an opportunity, having this discussion on the podcast, this is an opportunity for those that are seeing, addictions, any kind of substance abuse in their relationship or in themselves to look at what the substance is doing for you. And instead of, numbing yourself, can you work with a therapist or a coach who can help you deal with the underlying issues or root cause of neat feeling that you need the alcohol or other substances? And that's not something, that's going to change overnight. You're going to need to work with somebody who I hope you'll work with somebody who understands neurodiversity as well as substance abuse, because I think one of the most challenging things is when you are reaching out for help and somebody is qualified to help you in one area but doesn't understand your neurology. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's I agree. I absolutely agree. And dealing with it, if it's not dealt with properly, could introduce or inflame shame. And that will just, create an addiction that becomes harder to treat. But I don't think that you can really sufficiently treat chemical dependency without understanding, their neurology. And that could be why there's a lot of relapse. I don't know that there's been any research done on the relationship there. At least I haven't seen any, but I have, then again, I haven't actively, really done a deep dive, but I would be curious to know about that. That's a great point and question.
And I know I have some folks that listen that are PhD students or in master's programs. So I think this is an area that definitely needs research. I have not seen anything on it. It makes sense that relapse occurs so often I mean, it's just the norm. And if there's neurodiversity involved and unknown neurodiversity, I can totally understand why the relapse just keeps occurring and occurring and occurring. And it really does, I know, it does physical damage, it does emotional, spiritual, mental damage to the individual that's suffering and to any family members or intimate partner or, you know, their boss or other employees. And if, you know, just having this conversation, Nicole, can bring some awareness to folks and maybe somebody, you know, is helped by this, I think it's so important that we're having this discussion that is, I'm sure, very, very difficult for a lot of folks. So we are almost at the end, and I know this is, again, our last episode together, but I don't know if there's anything else that you want to share about these very, very, very important but very emotional topics that we've addressed today.
There is something that I want to add, and so I appreciate you doing, or, you know, giving me that time. And also, you know, I just want to really thank you so much for, you know, the opportunity and experience to do this with you. You really, you know, you've helped me heal in many ways. So
it's been a pleasure, Nicole. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. So what I want to just end with is that, and it's perfect with what, you know, you just said, it inspired me to think of this. And that's that with the substance abuse or with the, you know, alcohol, the drinking or whatever else there may be, a lot of this is, it can also be the expectations we have on our partners, especially if they're fathers, especially if they, you know, have an important job that's helping provide for the family. And then our expectations of what we need for the relationship, we're putting pressure on someone often who is already putting a lot of pressure on themselves. Many of the neurodivergent individuals that I work with, plus, you know, if I can speak from experience, we have very high expectations for ourselves, and failure is something that we're not good at and we don't like. And it's because, you know, for a lot of reasons, but also because, you know, maybe we carry a core wound of feeling inadequate or defective, or like, you know, we are a failure at some level. And so we try to overachieve. We work hard. If we're good at work, we're going to work really hard. We're going to be workaholics, possibly. We're going to do what we're really good at, because that's where we're getting our source of reinforcement, because we're failing at home. We're failing as parents, and at least we know our brain is able to help us succeed somewhere. We need that desperately, right?
Yeah.
So the more pressure that we're putting on those individuals who are already, you know, really overwhelmed, and you may not see it because, you know, we're also not great at it admitting that, it can show up that, oh, what is going to help me keep going is going to be maybe drinking, or maybe some habit like work, you know, working long hours or whatever it is, video games. Something has to be fueling the system. And if it's, you know, happening so much that it's, you know, looks like an addiction or it's concerning, you know, that's something to look at and maybe work through with a therapist, but also just being mindful of the fact that it's not helpful to put a lot of additional pressure onto a person who likely is giving as much as they can be.
Yeah. And Nicole, I think that's so important for both partners to hear, because I've said it before on the podcast, but I'll repeat it. My father was a psychologist. He passed away in 2005. He had an addiction to Valium and to cigarettes. He smoked 3 packs a day. He did not know he was autistic, but now my sister and I 100% sure he was autistic. He saw clients every day, but he only worked 3 days a week. He knew he couldn't see clients 5 days a week, which is amazing that he had that insight. And he used to spend a lot of time napping on the weekends. He just lie down on the couch and nap for hours. That was his way to recharge. But the Valium kept him going to work Tuesday through Thursday, writing his reports on Monday and Friday because that was his schedule. And the cigarettes also helped calm his nerves, and I do believe they were a stim. Did that create a lot of conflict between him and my mother? Absolutely. She almost divorced him several times when she asked him to stop the Valium, and he told her he did and he didn't. And when I got older, she shared some of these stories with me. But I do wonder, I really do wonder how their relationship could have been different if they had known they were a neurodiverse couple. I think I'm not sure if they would have stayed together. I don't know. I know they loved each other until the end, very much so. I still believe that they were in love with each other. But there was just so much conflict at times around things that could have been addressed and resolved if they had known they were a neurodiverse couple. And I just want to say to the listeners that if anything that we have talked about today resonates with you, whether you're the autistic or the non-autistic or neurotypical partner, please go to my website, find the resource page where I list all the coaches and therapists and counselors, including Nicole, that have been on the podcast. Reach out to somebody who understands neurodiversity and can help you individually, or you and your partner, you and your family. I do believe, I'm 100% sure, Nicole. I know we're both divorced, but we've, both had other relationships. I do believe there is hope, but when there is unknown neurodiversity, or there are unknown mental health issues, or there's a partner who doesn't want to face whatever they're going through and work to get to the other side, whatever that looks like. I do believe that we cause ourselves and our partners and our family and others so much unintentional hurt and pain that sometimes can't be repaired. And, that may be difficult for people to hear, but I think it's important. And I've had, the neurotypical folks ask me, what if I can't get over, all the hurt and the pain and what I thought was abuse? And I'm like, if you don't get over it, you are going to suffer for the rest of your life. If you don't heal, if you don't, find the way to the other side, and if possible, repair. If not, at least heal and forgive, you're going to suffer for the rest of your life because you can't change the past, Nicole. I mean, none of us can. I wish we could, but we can create a better present for ourselves. We can create, hopefully, a better future for ourselves. So I know I said a lot, so I want to give you one more chance if there's something else you want to say before we close out.
No, I love what you said, and that's absolutely true. I am more of an optimist, and so I always promote, let's try and heal. And I think that if you're unwilling to do your work, if you're unwilling to accept who your partner is, if you're unwilling to forgive and move forward and do the work to heal the past, then maybe it is better for you to end the relationship, because if you don't, the relationship isn't going to ever be what you want it to be, because you're still holding on to, pains and resentments of the past, and so you're bringing it into the future relationship. So that's the biggest decision and choice that you can make if you want the relationship that if you want the relationship to continue, and it doesn't have to. You can have a friendship afterwards, right? You can figure out another option. But if you want to stay and you want to make it work, you have to do those things. You have to heal the past and let go of that and accept your partner for who they are. And then you can start fresh and have a different relationship. But we all have to do our own work. That's the one thing I will say, and that's it.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way to end. Nicole, thank you from the bottom of my heart for being one of my guest co-hosts for this season, but also for the amazing work that you do. I know I've had a number of folks say I've reached out to Nicole, and I know that you've talked to folks or emailed back and forth with folks, and I'm sure there'll be many other folks as they listen to your episodes who will reach out to you. And if you could just share, and I'll put it in the show notes again, how do people find you, Nicole? What is the best place?
Absolutely. And yes, I am very appreciative when, you know, your listeners reach out. And I am happy to, you know, do consultations and talk to individuals to even help you guide, you know, which direction you need to go. I can be found on Psychology Today. It's Nicole Knowlton with a K, Knowlton. I'm also on Twitter, at aspietherapist.com, also Instagram, same name. And yeah, thank you. Thank you so much, Mona. It's just been an incredible experience for me. So I appreciate you.
Me too. I appreciate you too. Everyone, I hope that you will share this episode with somebody that you care about, whether you are the neurodivergent partner or the neurotypical partner, because this can be, I believe, some of the things we shared and talked about today can be life-changing.